If you're trying to curse, you can't hear.
That's bullshit.
Welcome to Nonprofits. My name's Atif.
I'm Robert.
I'm Scott.
We're going to talk about a paper that I guess it's a couple of years old, but it's interesting. It's relevant to sort of general forecasting. Let's talk about BS. Why don't you introduce the paper?
Yeah, so there's a paper, I think you said it was a couple years ago, I think that's right, called On the Reception and Detection of Pseudo-Profound Bullshit. So we're going to have to slap an explicit lyrics tag on this, because we're going to have to use the word bullshit a lot. But I think, Atif, you said you read this. About, I think in 2005, an academic philosopher named Harry Frankfurt wrote a really short book called On Bullshit. And, I didn't think the book was that interesting, but the basic point is interesting. And the basic point is to draw a distinction between knowingly lying, like I know what the truth is and I'm saying the opposite, and simply making stuff up without regard for whether it's true.
Yeah, but not haphazardly, designed to impress, is how you put it in the paper.
Right.
Saying things with the intention of impressing someone else without really caring about the underlying truth of what you're saying.
Right. And in practice, bullshit usually is false, right? Because you're not making any effort to find out it's true. And if you just make stuff up to suit you, probably it will only be true by accident.
It's probably false.
Right?
Correct.
And,
right.
And, you know, it's not necessarily any better than lying, even if you technically don't know you're lying, because you're not taking responsibility for whether or not it's true. You're still acting in bad faith for telling people, saying, believe me, as Trump does, without actually having any reason for them to believe you. So the book has experienced kind of a renaissance because of Trump and fake news. I think the conspiracy theory that spread after the Vegas shooting was a good example of bullshit, because maybe it's possible there was some conspiracy. I don't think there's any reason to believe that. But the people who came up with the theory, it wasn't like they were investigating what actually happened. They just made up something to troll people. Right? They just invented it. And if it had been true, it would have been an amazing coincidence.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you're right, too, about this. There being a renaissance because of Trump. And I think there was reportedly Obama referred to Trump as a bullshitter in a private conversation that was widely reported. And that's what I think a lot of people, we were talking before the podcast about the current Trump controversy, which is his attempts to console Gold Star families and sort of the ham-fisted or not particularly consoling ways he's approached it. I think I forget what the exact quote was, but his quote to one of the families that he apparently could not remember the neighbor, did not say the name of the person that he was calling about, and then said, well, he knew what he was signing up for. He knew what he was getting into, which I don't think anyone particularly wants to hear. But you had pointed out, Robert, that another bit of news that relates to Trump and his relationships with these people is he had apparently promised some family $25,000. And then just sort of did not follow up on that. And that seemed to be square within the definition of this paper's definition of bullshit, a statement that makes him sound good and does not seem to be particularly concerned with whether or not it's true.
Right. And now the amazing thing that really struck me about that was, you know, and the administration says, oh, he just hadn't sent the check yet, although he's got a long history of not sending checks until somebody says, hey, 2 years later, you never sent a check. But the amazing thing is he's willing to just do that in the moment to avoid a moment of awkwardness without any concern for the later consequences when somebody said, hey, you promised $25,000 and you didn't send it. And it's really cheap bullshit.
They're also often easy to prove that they're false, even in the second that they're said. So
right. He doesn't even seem to worry about it.
And there are times where they're not necessary. So he was saying recently with the four people who died in Niger that I think he was going to both call the family members, but also write letters. And they were saying he's already written the letters and he may either send them on Monday or Tuesday. And my thought is, this is really strange, because if you've written the letter, why wouldn't you send it immediately? You're not going to say, oh, well, I might send it Monday, but maybe we'll wait till Tuesday because I don't know in the White House if we can manage to get something to the post office. And to me, that was like, okay, the letter hasn't been written. They're going to, once they get it written, it'll be sent, which is fine. I mean, they could say, yeah, I'm giving this a lot of thought, whatever. But instead of just saying the truth, it's like, no, they make up some garbage that's instantly provable false. I shouldn't say provable is false, but really just doesn't make sense. And even like even like the comment that he made, allegedly made to the family of one of the soldiers who died, saying basically, well, he signed up for it, and well, I guess it probably hurts a lot anyway. If he had just simply said, you know, this is really tough for me, these are really, you know, these are really emotional things, and I may, and if I said anything wrong, if I said it in the incorrect way, you know, I'm sorry, because that really wasn't my intent. I really just want to honor the person's sacrifice and, you know, and console the family, and any, you know, ill that I caused by mistake, I regret, you know, that would be like a normal statement a person could make, but he's not capable of that sort of a comment.
All right. He's not emotionally capable of taking responsibility or even admitting.
And I think a lot of people would understand that. I mean, I don't know what to say to people at funerals.
There's no good answer. This is one of the hardest things a president does, and he can't fix it for these people. Yeah.
And I think plenty of people would understand that if he just like, you know, I made a mistake and I'm sorry. If I didn't mean to, if it was taken, you know, in a certain way, I really am sorry, because I know they're going through a lot and they don't need, you know, whatever. He could just say that. But that's, yeah, he can never backtrack what he's done. Everything must be a win. In Puerto Rico, we're getting a 10 right now, the efforts. I mean, it's like everything must be a giant win.
Oh, that's right. People are saying. Everybody says. But so getting back to the paper itself, the researchers were interested in bullshit receptivity.
They didn't want to know who bullshits. They wanted to know who falls for this shit.
Yeah, who falls for bullshit, under what are their qualities, under what circumstances.
They call them bullshittees. Bullshittee is actually a word from the paper.
Yep. They defined bullshit as something designed to impress, absent direct concern for the truth. They ran a series of studies. I think some of the participants were students, and then some of the participants were people that they recruited through Mechanical Turk. And they reached some conclusions, and some of them I don't think are particularly surprising conclusions. One was people who are more receptive to bullshit tend to be less reflective, lower cognitive ability, more prone to ontological confusion, conspiratorial ideation.
I found the idea of ontological confusion fascinating. People who are ontologically confused cannot distinguish between literally true things and metaphorical things.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the example they gave.
Yeah. Here's the explanation of ontological confusion. Participants were given the following instructions. Do you think the following statements can be literally true, the way a sentence such as Wayne Gretzky was a hockey player is true? Or are they only true in a metaphorical sense, like friends are the salt of life? So essentially, they gave them sentences and asked them, is this a metaphor or is this literally true? And they had them rate them. So they had questions like, a rock lives for a long time, and ask you if it's
right.
And that's a little bit weird, because rocks aren't alive, so I guess that part is metaphorical. But on the other hand, if you sort of broaden the meaning of live as exist in some way, maybe it's literal, rocks are around a long time. So they asked people to make these distinctions. And people who weren't good, who, you know, the people who use literally wrong, these were the ones who were more prone to fall for bullshit.
Yes. And then the stuff that we sort of would expect, which was whether you believe in supernatural, whether you believe in things like alternative medicine, paranormal belief, which it feels a little unfair, but I kind of get where they're coming from. So one of the ways that they tested bullshit, and I feel really bad about this.
I don't.
They talk about Deepak Chopra a lot, and it's specifically how he'll make these statements, and they go to pains in the paper to say not everything he says is full of shit. But they do point out he says a lot of things that are kind of pseudo-profound. And then what they did was they kind of took buzzwords from Deepak Chopra, his Twitter feed, and they scrambled them, but they scrambled them in a way so that they had the syntax of a regular sentence. So it wasn't just random words. It read as a sentence, but it was just sort of divorced from all meaning. And some people were willing to rate those scrambled, randomized Deepak Chopra words as profound in a way that other people were not. And that was taken as a measure of how receptive they were to bullshit.
Right. So you can go, there's actually a website that does this. It's called thewisdomofchopra.com. And you can go there and it'll give you a Deepak Chopra mashup tweet. And these are things like, again, if they were true, if they were profound, it would be by coincidence, because no one wrote them. These isn't things that Deepak Chopra wrote. So I went there and I got, your heart is the womb of the mechanics of Marvel.
Mechanics must be a key word, because there's one in this paper where it says attention and inattention are the mechanics of manifestation. So
I think
on it, mechanics.
Yeah, it gives a sort of air of something literal happening. And you can project meaning onto that sentence. I can give it some meaning, some idea of my own, and read that into it. It's not that hard to do, but it's also so unclear what it might mean. It's kind of a cipher that it doesn't necessarily mean anything. Like I can't necessarily say that it's clear that what he's talking
and
about.
And so one of the things I'm curious about with bullshit is if it's basically more powerful because people are afraid to say, I really just don't understand this. Because if I say I don't understand this, then I sound like I'm dumb. So if something is somehow vague, then it's like, okay, we'll just nod and go along with it. Because to say,
yeah,
what the hell does this mean? That's not supportable. So
it doesn't have to be that they're just too ashamed to admit that they don't know. I mean, it could be it, but they offer a couple of hypotheses. And one is just that some people are more credulous, that if you tell them something, they're just going to, they have too open a mind. They're like, yeah, sure, that sounds right. And it's interesting. That's interesting to me because one of the things that makes a good forecaster is that they score highly on a measure of what they call active open-mindedness. But the authors of this paper distinguish between sort of passive open-mindedness and active open-mindedness. In active open-mindedness, you're willing to consider something, but you also sort of check to see if it's true. So you might hear a conspiracy theory and say, well, that sounds unlikely, but I'll consider it.
Right.
And then you go and you do some kind of test in your mind to try to verify, disconfirm it. That's active open-mindedness. This is kind of a passive open-mindedness where you just receive things and go like, oh, yeah, sure, I believe that now that you said
it. Yeah, that might be right. Right. Yeah, they talk about that in the paper. I think they say good reasoners are people who have the intelligence and cognitive ability and also the willingness to engage in that kind of, I think they refer to it as deliberative reasoning.
Right. Skepticism.
Yeah.
To some extent, the other hypothesis, some people are just not skeptical. They don't test things very carefully.
Yeah. I will say, though, reading through it, I felt a little bad for their participants. I guess one of the... It's a soft criticism of study, but there is a line of philosophy and vigilance. Like when you think of the Zen koan and that kind of thing, like there is a area of religious study and philosophical study that does involve finding meaning in something that is meaningless and sort of trying to use that as a way to reflect on things, almost like a Rorschach test or almost like a way to, I think, explore what a person is thinking through quasi-random stimuli. Or something that doesn't really make a lot of inherent sense. So I could see someone who was in a kind of spiritually or religiously receptive frame of mind looking at something and looking for meaning in it in a way that to me is different from simply looking at something and passively saying, yeah, all right, whatever. That makes sense.
Right. But you wouldn't react the same way if you realized that the sentence was written sort of randomly by a machine. Okay, some of that is that you're attributing this idea that somebody intended something by it. And that's part of why, you know, but this is, it reminds me a little bit of part of Wittgenstein's critique of philosophy. He says a lot of philosophy is like, you know, somebody draws a picture of a person and says, this is a person. And then the kid or somebody else in this is like, you know, academic philosophers, they draw a scribble and they're like, okay, well, then what's this? Well, you've kind of missed the whole point of representational drawing at that point. If you just remix things and then try to interpret them, you know, because I thought a lot of philosophy was like just trying to see meaning in scribbles.
Unfortunately, I'm reading a book by him right now. Called
by Wittgenstein?
Yeah, called Uncertainty.
Uncertainty's great. Yeah. What do you mean, unfortunately? In Uncertainty, he actually wonders whether or not he has a brain.
Yeah.
Well, and he concludes that he can't know, but it doesn't make sense for him to doubt it.
Right, and he starts off with the thing of, you know, basically, if I can admit that here is my hand, then everything else, you know, follows from that. But if I can't admit that here is my hand, you know, I can't prove that here is my hand, then what do I have? How can I, you know, how can I basically do anything?
You know, there's another... I think it makes an important point. There's another paper that came out relatively recently. I think it was actually just last couple of months ago. And it basically found that people who believe in conspiracy theories and paranormal activity, and this is correlated supposedly with bullshit receptivity, were also people who are more likely to see a pattern in random data.
Yeah.
Give them a set of coin flips or dots.
Right.
They would connect the dots and say, oh, there's a face in here, when in fact the data was random. So there is a sense in which some of this could be connected to overfitting data, to assuming that there is some underlying cause and not really understanding randomness. And I think this is something that humans in general are kind of bad at. We are always looking for underlying explanations and are not very good at identifying random phenomena. Like, one of the things they found is that when you ask humans what a random data set looks like, they actually think it's very evenly mixed. But in real random data, there's a lot of clumps. When humans see clumps, we're like, well, something must be causing those clumps. No, if you just throw a lot of darts at the wall, there's some clumping. That's how randomness works out.
Yeah,
so maybe a lot of this is about an inability to really perform pattern recognition and evaluate theories and ideas. I mean, that's one of the things that strikes me about a lot of conspiracy theories is they are just so improbable. They depend on a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense. That if you really just think about it, you'd be like, if you watch that movie, you'd be like, come on, this is ridiculous. But people, they're unable to see that often.
It's interesting, though, because we each have our own biases. And so there was, in the last few days, it probably has been around for a long time, but there was basically something going around that Melania Trump, that there's a body double for her. And that
Cloned. Yeah, everyone knows cloned. That she's a clone.
Yeah. And or not even that she's cloned, but even if we want to be a bit more practical, there's just somebody who looks similar to her.
Replicant.
Yeah. And there have been people that, you know, when they have the presidential limousines, that you have the body double for security reasons. But this has gone beyond that.
Did you see the video?
I didn't see the video. I just saw a still from it. And it was interesting because, like, you look in the still and it's like, okay, the nose is slightly wider. The mouth is slightly upturned, you know, one way or
the
other.
She looks weird.
Yeah,
she definitely looks weird.
Yeah. And,
but it's like it's filmed through like a screen or something.
Yeah,
like it's behind a window screen. So I think there's some weird effect going on.
And there's also the possibility, obviously, that people can manipulate photos at this point, or that it's just different light. There's all sorts of things that can make things happen. But I thought in this case, actually, liberals would be more likely to be saying, "Yeah, this is true," than Trump supporters. You know, because this would support the narrative of liberals that something is, you know, certainly wrong with the Trump administration. So normally we want to say, all the Trump supporters are crazy and we're all right. But in this case, it's flipped around because it fits our bias of what we would expect Trump to do. Our view.
Right. There is magical thinking on both sides of the aisle. I think to some extent, the current Republican Party has coalesced some of the magical thinkers over to its side. They're deliberately appealing to them.
They're pushing for a monopoly.
They're everywhere. I mean, they're everywhere, right? We all know these. The weird thing about that is I don't think there's any reason to believe that they've got a stand in for Melania. But at this point, like, I don't want to become one of these conspiracy thinkers, but like, it wouldn't even be the weirdest thing. Like, I feel like I have to be actively open-minded. I have to entertain almost any weird theory. Does she have a stand-in? I'm not going to rule it out.
Yeah.
Seems unlikely.
Yeah, I tried to check it as much as I could, and then I got to the point of, I spent about 5 minutes on it. It's like, okay, this isn't worth my time, and I don't care. I don't care if
you've got a life to lead.
Yeah, whether they do or don't, it doesn't matter. So if there's an actual stand-in for the president, that would be more significant. But
I thought the lizard people were only controlling the Obama administration. If they're probably the Trump administration, too, we're screwed.
There's a New Yorker piece this year. I think I don't remember if I sent it to you guys. It's called Why Facts Don't Change Our Minds. And it talks about a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in the podcast and that we've done, like the sort of training we've gone through with the things that we discuss in GGI amongst ourselves, the different cognitive biases, the things to be Dunning-Kruger, stuff to be aware of. And one of the things the piece talks about is this research, which is a lot of cognitive biases don't make sense from an intellectual perspective. But it does from an interactionist, I think is the term they use, perspective. And there's this body of research that says things like groups kind of cementing their ideas, even if like cementing around a certain idea, being willing to discount facts that go against what they previously believe, all these different biases are ways of maintaining group function, like group cohesion, and have a primitive adaptive function that now in a world where we don't need that kind of tribal cohesion are pernicious. And that makes sense to me. So I guess my question to you guys is, after reading this this bullshit paper, the paper on bullshit, because the paper wasn't bullshit, what sort of practical takeaways do you have from it? Because I mean, part of what they say is, they talk about things like cognitive load and how people who are cognitively taxed find it more difficult to engage in critical thinking. And we could say that there are certain things like sort of your raw intelligence can affect your ability to engage in that kind of discriminating thinking that we think it should be cultivated if you're going to be a critical thinker who can see through bullshit. But I would say maybe from a policy perspective, what takeaways would you apply from this paper if you could advise some agency on how to make people, and this is not pie in the sky because we know that other countries are actively training their citizens to be better consumers of news and to be better at spotting fake news and teasing through bullshit. So what in the United States, what kind of policies do you think would make sense in terms of alleviating the problem?
It's tough because on one hand, you'd like to just be able to educate people and get them to think more critically, but it's difficult because they have to trust you enough to take that in on some level and want to be part of your in-group. You know, the interesting thing about the in-group mechanics, by the way, is that the more outrageous the belief, the more it identifies you with a certain group. So if you believe that Obama was born in Kenya, then that, you know, is a lot more distinguishing than just believing, you know, I don't know, that something really mundane.
Right.
But yeah, I think there was a, so while I'm talking about, was this also a Samantha Bee segment? You see, I watched Samantha Bee. She did another segment where
she's good.
Where she went to Finland and talked about what they've done. And they have done a campaign of educating people to identify fake stories, what's been planted by Russia, because they have that issue there as well. But there's also different ways in which you can combat fake stories. One of the things that doesn't work is when Trump lies, says something, or bullshit, says something that's false, leading the headline with Trump says this, but it's not true. People hear this. They hear the lie. Yeah. They don't hear the rebuttal. Whereas you could say, you could have a headline instead that says, this is the truth and Trump's a liar.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, that undermines it in a better way.
That's a really good point. And I've seen that elsewhere. This idea that if people keep repeating a falsehood and saying, oh, it's false, people tend to forget the fact that you've repeated this thing and said it's false. They tend to just remember they heard a thing and then say, oh, yeah, maybe that's true. So simply repeating a lie and saying, oh, yeah, this thing we keep talking about, it's not true, it's not true, can anchor it in people's minds as something that's true.
Right.
Well, one of the comments I think in the bullshit paper was that basically people are predisposed to think that most things that we're told are true. And so to, in a way, to combat that, it's like if you gave kids a test and you gave them 50 statements and half of them were BS, then probably pretty soon you would start looking for patterns, thinking, yeah, most of what I'm being, or not most, but there's almost an equal chance that anything I'm told is true or false. So I'm going to be very open to the way I look at it, to, you know, to looking for ambiguity, looking for problems. But at the same time, studying philosophy, I can also get to the point where I basically don't want to accept anything, and that doesn't help either.
Right.
You know, if I'm just like, okay, everything is garbage, so why, I can't trust anything, I'm just going to go.
Why wait?
Don't be nihilistic. Yeah. So, but this paper, one of the things they did was they basically mixed in supposedly meaningful statements, sort of folk wisdom of some kind, with randomly generated Deepak Chopra comments, and they asked people to distinguish them. And that's something we don't really have anything. We don't ever do that in school. We don't get a thing and piece of paper, and we're not asked to evaluate which of these things make no sense. But maybe that could be an exercise we could do.
Have you had classes? I had to take a class in symbolic logic, and so we actually deconstructed sentences and put them into formulas. And
but I'm not just talking about validity and soundness. Like I think at some level, bullshit can seem valid if you construct a whole bullshit syllogism.
Sure.
I think that's right. There is a, it's funny. I had a friend of mine text me this week because he was asking about Missouri is one of the few states. So there was I think in response to 9/11, maybe in 2005, the Real ID law was passed. And states have had a long time to comply with getting their state IDs up to a point where the federal government would like them to be. And there are a handful of states that for various political reasons said, we don't want a big government database of whatever, and no amount of disclaiming could get them to go against this position. And Missouri was one of them. And Missouri in 2009, I believe, passed a law saying, the Department of Revenue cannot comply with these requirements because we think this is big government taking our data, whatever. So this was a great position to take when it didn't matter. But now that we were at a point where you will not be able to fly without a passport, if you just show a Missouri driver's license, Missouri this summer changed the law and then applied hat in hand for an extension so that they could bring their IDs up to date. And I mention this because there are states, and we know the states, and there are groups, and know the groups, to whom any systematic attempt, particularly by the government, to educate people in this way, to educate how people think, is going to be seen as a negative, as an attack. And in the United States, we have, I mean, we still have vigorous arguments about basics in textbooks. Like, do we refer to slavery as slavery? Do we teach creationism and evolution side by side? Do we talk about global warming? And because underlying facts have now become political footballs, I think it would be hard in the States, because there's such a low social trust right now, to, I guess I should say hard. I'm not quite sure what form that kind of training would take. Because I agree. I mean, it's like, Scott, you have gone to places and trained people on how to forecast, which in part is training them on how to think critically and how to be willing to engage in this kind of process of thinking about something, thinking about why you're thinking about it, evaluating data, all that stuff. I wonder how that would look in the United States, given the this hostility towards any kind of big government program, particularly one that was designed to address how people think.
Well, one thing that I could say, and this is separate from trying to make something legislation and pass it nationwide, but even when I deal on an individual level, the trainings that I've participated in, I think were successful because they were basically, I was in a room full of people who were already analytical, who wanted to become better. And so this is not actually that hard. But when I have people that I know who are incredibly, it's interesting because in a way, there are people who are very skeptical of many things, which would make them very resistant to bullshit. But actually, it's not the case. You know, people who are basically conspiracy theorists, some of their views are so, they're so entrenched. But basically, if they feel that the whole system is somehow, you know, basically, I'm not saying the reptile people, but basically they have so many ideas that everything is controlled by, you know, whether it's, I don't know, that there's basically big powers above us that make everything happen. And, you know, I don't know how to approach those people. And I really haven't had luck with several people I know well. You know, it's like how, if somebody's not really able to look at sort of scientific method as a way to analyze fact, I don't know what to do.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because, like, I also know people who I think are otherwise very smart people, critical thinkers, who engage in conspiracy theory. And one of the results of the paper, the bullshit paper, was that bullshit sensitivity was associated with a lower paranormal belief, so you're more sensitive to bullshit, but not conspiratorial ideation or I think receptivity to alternative medicine.
There was a little bit something weird about that, though, because they found some correlations with those things when they just looked at the willingness to believe that BS sentences were profound. But then they tried to distinguish between just a willingness to believe in BS sentences and an ability to discriminate between BS and real sentences. Mm-hmm. And then the data got a little bit funny. Like, they started to say that the sensitivity, the ability to discriminate, wasn't correlated with alternative medicine or, but the data's a lot messier at that point. I thought that it was a lot less clear that those correlations were really sensitive. In some ways, the way they tried to distinguish between receptivity and discrimination, I'm not sure all of that was good. That was actually my methodological problem with the paper. But I mean, you know, they did suggest that the ability to discriminate was less correlated with some of those things.
Yeah.
I remember a very mind-numbing conversation I had recently.
Yep.
This summer I was in London, and I was with a group of, let's say, mostly bright people doing some sort of solstice observance, which isn't really my thing, but fine, they were doing it. So I was there with a bunch of Ukrainian people, and it was a cool thing. It was interesting to just like be in a park in London. But one person was telling me was talking about how our actual heart, our physical heart, is somehow, you know, like our soul is there, it's not in our brain. But it started going into sort of this strange thing. And I said, okay.
That sounds ontologically confused.
Yeah, and I was like,
classic definition.
And I was like, but there's people now who've had heart transplants or artificial hearts,
right?
So they don't have a soul,
right? Or,
you know, it's like,
yeah, you have a pig.
Oh, that's true, though. Do you think if someone has a pig heart, they have a soul?
No, it's gone.
They don't.
It's gone.
Well, no, they have a pig.
I may have one of those.
Which is weird.
Yeah, but these were educated people. You know, these were not you know, somebody from the who's never read, who's basically living a 16th century life.
Yeah, and I know. And sometimes it's a veneer of science. I just saw something from some men's group about how all of human suffering is caused by epigenetic changes to our DNA. And no, but that's a science word.
Yeah. And she was trying to use the veneer of science because I don't remember the whole discussion, but it was basically about how, you know, they've detected waves, you know, from the heart or something like this. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I've actually been
an EKG.
I've been in an ER when somebody died or was dead. I don't know. We were, I volunteered in a hospital for a while. And it's like, if a person gets close to another person, we have electricity that transfers through, that's picked up on the EKG. But that's different than saying, you know, my soul is going into this other person. Of course, I can't prove that my soul didn't go into this other person.
So you don't believe in transmigration.
Yeah, but since I can't prove it, then I'm just as crazy as she is. Yeah, so one thing, how do you create a national policy to make people better, more bullshit resistant? But I don't even know how to do it on an individual level.
Well, I think one thing the paper didn't look at that maybe would have been interesting is that I think people have sometimes a psychic need to believe in conspiracy theories at a certain time. They want to, in some ways, conspiracy theories impose order on the world. They help explain there's a bunch of random stuff and you feel out of control. A conspiracy theory makes you think there's a reason for it, and that's comforting. Or you feel put upon in some way. So you psychically... people may want to say people are out to get me, right? Any kind of paranoia, or these are ways of dealing with chaos and unhappy events in our life. And I don't know how you deal with that.
It's not like I'm failing because I forgot to prepare.
Right.
It's actually that there's somebody else. Right.
And that's why Trump has so many conspiracy theories, because he knows that it wasn't his fault. It must be that everybody is out to get him. Right? But I think that one way you can address that, like I don't think that a lot of the Trumpist nativism is really about economics, but I do feel that for some people in America, they feel the social compact has broken down. Now, to some extent, that may just be because they're no longer, you know, get as much white privilege, and I can't feel very sorry for that. But I think that one way of addressing some of these issues is to make people feel as much as possible there is a social compact where society is valuing them. And the more you can do that, the less people need to resort to, conspiracy theories that make them feel, that explain things in their life that feel out of control. That's a big task.
Yeah, makes sense.
Can I ask a personal question? We've been doing these podcasts for a while.
Yeah.
I like you both. You both
all right, where's the butt?
Uh-oh.
No, there's no butt at all. So, I agree with the points that you made. What, and this is not particularly related to the bullshit discussion, although it kind
what's
of
what's the
is,
personal question among pins and needles?
Yeah.
When you say, because I agree with you. I think there is. I think part of it is this kind of loss of. I mean, it's explicit. The kind of white identity and white privilege. Why don't you feel like white privilege is something worth defending? Like, as a white dude, you would benefit from it. So, what is it that makes you say? And there are clearly millions of people. I would say the majority of people who say, "Yeah, this is not for me." But what is it that makes you say, "Yeah, I don't need that. I don't want that."
Well, in some ways, you know, if you have a privileged life, it's easy to say, "I don't need privilege." But I don't really, at least intellectually, want advantages. I want to be on a level playing field. I don't think it's good for someone to, you know, be treated as better than other people. You know, not to say that I haven't taken advantage of things that have been handed me or made more easy because I'm a white guy.
Right.
It's also like, it seems very short-sighted to look at the world and say, this benefits me, therefore it's good. You know, in some ways, it's just an accident that I was born a white man. I could just as easily been, I think, born anything else. I don't think that's some kind of fundamental thing that, like, I should be proud of. So how can you not empathize with our brothers and sisters around the world who are not white, not male?
This is the Rawls justice argument.
Right.
This is
this is something like an argument. I could be any one of these other people. So even if I'm not, I ought to care for them as if I were. I ought to give them, to fight for them because they deserve everything I deserve. And that's what I fundamentally believe.
Yeah. I also think it goes into how I feel about myself and what I want to do. So I shouldn't say obviously, but I have much more privilege than most people are born with, even though I was born, truly middle class. I wasn't born upper class.
Middle class in the U.S. is still some pretty good privilege.
Yeah. But if I even look, let's say within my state, I could say I would be born quite in the middle, although I had the fortune of having parents that were educated. So that's still an advantage, even if financially we were, straight middle class. But I still want to have the feeling that if I, if I work hard, if I do certain things, I have the ability to, you know, to improve my life. And if it's only privilege, then that is meaningless. And I don't really want to live in a world where I only get things simply because of birth. And then I should just screw around. It doesn't matter what I do. So that's on the sort of selfish side. So the selfish side, only looking inward, is saying I want to be in a system where meritocracy matters, because that helps motivate right. me. And I think not only myself, but I think it makes the whole society better. On the other side is simply, I really don't see it's fair. Obviously, you don't have to have a daughter to care about, you know, girls or women, but I do have a daughter, and it's right. like, I want her to have the same chances as everybody else. I had a house painting company, and I hired a woman, and a guy wanted to quit. He didn't want to work where there was a woman in the job. And I was like, okay, but I also have a wife. And so she, he literally sent me a note at midnight saying, I got a fax saying that if I hired this person, he was going to quit. And it's like, okay, so my wife shouldn't have a chance.
What kind of person, like, this is what he's staying up night thinking about?
Yeah. It got more bizarre than that. I mean, it really got weird, but yeah, but I want to live in a world where people are, you know, where everybody basically has a chance. But I also think that there's a part about order that if you have a very stratified society, well, like basically a caste system, I also think it doesn't promote stability. Maybe it did promote stability in India for a long time. But I think basically, if you want to avoid things like violent revolutions, it's good if everybody does feel that they have a chance to move up or down.
Sure. This is kind of a Hegelian theory of history. Yeah. You know, so I think that the way privilege works, a lot of it is that people pretend they don't have it. They don't see it, don't want to see it. Yeah. I think a lot of people, if they really know they're getting an unfair advantage, maybe they wouldn't want it. I was actually thinking, apparently this quote is actually from Barry Switzer, the former college football coach. He's a pro coach too, I forgot. But he said at one point that some people are born on third base and go through thinking they hit a triple.
That's right.
And I think that's a lot of people, they're born on third base and they think, I'm such a great baseball player, I got here on my own. That's a way of not seeing that your advantage is that you don't deserve them in some way or didn't earn them. And I think that's how people defend it. But if you really see all the things, I mean, it's easy not to see. If you're a white person, you don't see that you can go to the police and not worry that you'll be accused of being the criminal. Yeah. Why would I even think that? Like, I don't have that experience. Right. But those are things that you get that black people don't get. They have a different relationship often. Not always, right? But sometimes they don't know for sure if the authorities are going to treat them like an upstanding citizen, even if they are.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, it is interesting. One of my takeaways from the paper, and we've known this. I mean, we've done plenty of interviews, and we've obviously interacted with each other for years. I do think that there is people who are less receptive to bullshit and who are more willing to engage in critical thinking are just that. They're willing to do it. Like, there's to some extent, you have to have the cognitive capability, but you also have to have the willingness to do it. And there's, I think, an emotional component, because sometimes it can be emotionally taxing to confront an unpleasant reality, and some people don't want to do it. But you also have to be willing to engage in the kind of puzzle of breaking something down and looking at what you know and what you actually know and what you just think you know, and comparing that with reality. And you have to be willing to, I mean, we talk about this cognitive load, but there's a certain amount of simply just putting in the hours, like saying, okay, I'm going to spend an hour or 2 hours not being spoon-fed information, but seeking out sources of information that I think are credible and trying to familiarize myself with something. And it's hard to do. I mean, we all do it regularly, and it can take a lot of time.
I'm also curious about areas that each person has a concern about. So, for instance, the next podcast is going to be about basketball. When I lived in America, I actually watched basketball a lot. I enjoyed it. Now I don't watch it much. I started watching it again in Sibiu Live. But basically, I haven't put time into knowing much about basketball in the U.S. So if you told me that any team was great, I could be like, yeah, sure, why not? And I will put some time in.
The Bulls are going to be great this year.
Yeah, sure. Because Jordan's great, you know, but I mean, I'd be like back like that. But at the same time, for most people, what we study is also not interesting to them. So for the average person in America, what's happening in Catalonia is probably not very relevant to their life. their lives.
Even what's happening in the United States, I think a lot of people don't think it matters that much to their life. Although I think it was originally Plato that said, there's several variations on it. There's a statement, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Yeah. I think I may be getting the order back, because I think Tolstoy changed that to, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. And just this idea that you can go around saying, I'm not interested in politics, but actually the truth is that it will affect your life. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. They think, I don't have to worry what's going on in Washington. But that, in some ways, is another example of privilege. That things in the U.S. have been so stable that people's lives have been, you know, not terribly affected for the most part by what happens by national politics. That could be changing.
But from a time management perspective, if you're an average, whatever average is, if you're an average person, should you,
you
go
got a job to go to?
Should you go spend the week? You're living in Hawaii. Should you spend the weekend surfing?
I really should.
Or reading more about, you know, the
Jeff
different
sessions.
Yeah. So yeah, if it's not your job to read about sessions, you need to vote. It's good to, you know, to stay somewhat active, but at what level do you say, I'm not going to question everything that comes across my desk because I have other things I want to do. I want to go have an ice cream and walk in the park. So,
but I really don't want to believe things that are wrong. I mean,
sure,
to me, the whole
either.
Point of believing something is that you want to believe the things that are true. Like that, otherwise you're just, but I don't think that everyone feels the same way or has the same commitment to it. I think sometimes a lot of people subconsciously, I don't think this is a conscious program, just want to believe what's easy to believe in some way, what that disrupts their life the least to believe, what upsets other people the least to believe. There's a lot of this in-group thing. And I don't think that's a terribly good way to go through life, but I understand it. I understand why there's a value in, not searching out on inconvenient truths.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. But certainly there's a pernicious global effect when there are certain people who are willing to just kind of let stuff ride. And it's, I mean, we see it now in our domestic politics, where the behavior of one group is absolutely fucking infuriating to the other group. Baffling. I'm not going to say which group I'm part of, but I will say group A just baffled the fuck out of group B.
Well, I think both sides are baffled by each other,
yeah.
Although I'm much more sympathetic to one side's bafflement, and I won't say.
Yep.
But if I bring up a different concept, and this isn't really bullshit, although to me it borders on it, if you look at something like gun control, there's definitely a group of people who say, I need to defend myself, I need to defend my family, and I can understand that idea. And they're like, okay, I need to have a gun to do that. And so if you're trying to take that away, you're risking my family. And that's unacceptable. And the government, if it becomes out of control, I need to be able to stop that. Now, I also think that line of reasoning doesn't make sense, that your pistol is going to stop it, or even your AK-47 is going to stop it.
But all of this so far is a reasonable discussion that we can have.
Right.
The problem is when when facts start getting made up to support positions. Like, that's when it goes off the rails to me. It's one thing to say, here's my reason, this is my I feel, and we can talk about that. Yeah. It's another to pretend things aren't true just because they're inconvenient to your argument.
Yeah, and I just saw something in the last week where I think there was a number like 2 million... I don't know what you call it. Basically, 2 million attacks were stopped last year in America by guns. And I thought, wow, that's a number I haven't heard. And that one sounds like it's very motivated by a gun company. I can't prove it wrong.
No, although I don't know of any methodology that's figuring that out. Like, that's super speculative.
Yeah, because first of all, most people who use a gun to stop an attack probably aren't calling the police. So they're not going to be captured, but that number also seems really, really high, because it's like, okay, that means like 1 in 100 people, or not 1 in 100, but let's say 1 in 150 people are being attacked each year, and they use a gun to stop it. And that's just, maybe it's happening.
Well,
if it is, it's a really spooky world.
I think the methodology has to be that there are a lot of attacks that would have happened that don't happen because somebody had an AK in their home.
Yeah.
But if you actually do a correlation between, you know, attacks and the number of guns in countries, you get a negative correlation, or sorry, a positive correlation.
Yeah.
More guns means more attacks.
Yeah, I understand.
So
that.
So, that's whatever. Somebody had some methodology, but I'm going to be very dubious about that one.
And so that's what I was going to say, is the ability to look at something and say, that seems so far out of the norm that I am not going to just take that, prima facie. But if it's something like, if somebody said 20,000 were stopped, I might be like, wow, okay, I might want to research that a bit. I don't know. But that somehow seems in the realm of normal, because if we have 30,000 deaths a year, that sounds somehow plausible. And my my BS meter doesn't just go, you know, through the roof. And so that's like this other question is, where does your heuristic BS meter kick in? And where do you
all valuable empirical questions that we could answer to try to figure this out. And maybe we would discover that having guns, at least in the United States, does stop a lot of attacks, that we are, in fact, safer if we actually do a lot of studies. I don't think that's what we're going to discover.
Right.
But we're actually not even allowed to do the research.
Sure.
That a lot of this is, the funding's been taken away from the CDC for this kind of stuff because people who support guns or who support gun rights are afraid the facts won't line up with them. And that's not good.
Right.
Like, let's have the discussion, find out what the truth is. And then, hey, if people who want gun control are wrong, then they'll have to explain away these inconvenient facts.
Yeah.
But don't just pretend the world isn't there and refuse to look at it, honestly.
I agree.
That's crazy.
That's bullshit. All right. We'll be back next week. We're going to have a sports podcast, an NBA podcast, which I'm really looking forward to.
And a guest, right?
If there are still any players who aren't injured.
There have been some catastrophic injuries already. Brendan Hayward, Jeremy Lin, I think Draymond Green's knee MRI was negative. But yeah, I mean, clearly that is going to affect.
I'm actually curious. I would like to know if there's clumping of injuries at the beginning of the season when people are out of shape. Because it does seem like a lot. Is this the case every year or is this just this year?
I don't know. It could be random. I mean, there are a lot of we'll talk about it next week. There are a lot of different factors that could be affecting it. The NBA season started earlier this
year.
Totally
took me by surprise.
I find it hard to believe that the 2 weeks or whatever would make that much of a difference, but maybe it does. I mean, in football, there's that argument that losing the preseason training has affected the quality of play and the safety of play for players. But we'll see. And then Scott, who does not know much, I think it's fair to say.
I know Patrick Ewing, so I was very happy when you set me up. That was back in my time.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, Georgetown Zone. You're going to come up with we'll discuss the process that you use to come up with a.
I'm just
going
to say who's going to win the championship, and that's it.
All right. Sounds good.
Maybe we give him a little harder question than that, though.
Ah.
I think the Clippers question is a good question. But we'll see. We'll talk about it between now and then. Okay, guys. For our listeners, thank you for listening. Tell your friend, rate us on iTunes or Stitcher, whatever platform you use. Nonprofitspod@gmail.com. If you have any questions, nonprofitspod.wordpress.com. If you want to leave a comment, we'll be back next week. Thanks,
guys.
Thanks. All right, bye, guys.